Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week, our guest will be Rabbi Zev Lef of Moshe Matisyo, and the topic will be Das Torah. Additionally, we will have the executive VP of the Agudas Yisrael, Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, Talmud Chacham, and constitutional lawyer. He will be discussing the gay marriage and the Agudas position, its Supreme Court brief. Next week, we will have with us Rabbi Ari Marburger, and the topic will be going to secular courts. Is there ever a time for it? I mean, sadly, some of the Batei Dinim today, reputationally, many people consider maybe not the best place to litigate. So do we always have to go? Is there a makim? What is the halachic position on that? And he's certainly one of the world's experts, certainly in America, the experts on Chayshe Mishpat. Additionally, from Eretz Yisrael, we will have Rabbi Usher Weiss, and he will be speaking about the kosher switch, or maybe the unkosher switch. We've heard Rabbi Heinemann, the Abbezin of Baltimore's position. Now let's hear the Minchas Usher's position on the kosher switch. So let's go straight to our guest. We have on the air with us from Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Zev Lef, who is the Rav of Moshe Matisyo, a religious community just outside Kiryas Sefer and Modi'in. He is a prolific Magid Shir, and he speaks at schools, yeshivas, seminaries, community centers all around the world. He's also the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Gedola Matisyo. Welcome, Rabbi Lef.
Thank you.
So, Rabbi Lef, we wanted to speak to you about a topic that anybody who's been to a yeshiva, a beis medrash, a kollel, a seminary, we grew up with the concept of Das Torah. And we wanted to ask you, what is the makor of Das Torah? Because it's not mentioned, not in the Gemara, not in Medrash, not in Zohar, not in Sifri, Sifra, Tosefta. It's not in the Rishonim, it's not in Shulchan Aruch, it's not in the Ge'onim, it's not in the Achronim. It first appears 100 years ago for the first time. So where does it come from? And a religion like Yiddishkeit, which is so based on Messiah, how is it possible that for the first, 3,400 years of our existence, we didn't have this concept? So where does this come from?
Okay, first of all, perhaps those words, Das Torah, in that context, aren't found in any of those sources. However, the concept of Emunas Chachomim, which is the foundation of Das Torah, is one of the foundations of the Torah itself. The first Makor, obviously, is Vayaminu Bashem Uva Moshe Avdo, that Klal Yisrael exists on the word of the Ribbono Shel Olam, as it is transmitted by the Chachamim every generation from Moshe Rabbeinu and on. And without the Emunas Chachamim and the Das Torah of those Chachamim, there is no Torah. So the fundamental basis of Torah is Das Torah, if you would have it.
Well, Rabbi Lef, can we define what is Das Torah? Before we, what is the what is Das Torah?
Okay, the Das Torah, I think, has to be divided into three different areas. One is purely the halachic area, and then the hashkafic area, and then those ideas that are etzes, advice from a Talmud Chacham or whatever. Some of that advice has halachic and hashkafic implications, even if they're not directly halachic and hashkafic, and some have absolutely no bearing on halach and hashkafa. A person wants to know if you should make a business deal or not. Right? Should he go to a chacham to get his opinion that Das Torah, and does he have to have emunas chachamim in that area? So let me speak about each one, if that's okay with you. The halachic area. There the Torah says specifically, right, that you should go el hashofet asher yiyah bayomim haheim. Right, every generation, as the Sefer Chinuch says very clearly, every generation has its Torah authority, and every place has its Torah authority. The Morah d'Asra, the Rav of that place, who people accept as their Rav. And there is a Torah mitzvah, kechol asher yarucha, to follow the Das Torah, to have emunas chachamim of the chachamim who are have that authority. And lo saser, not to sway from that, yamin u'smal, even if you think what they're saying is right and you think it's left and vice versa. That is clear halacha. And when there is machlokas between various chachamim, right, the Rosh says that every generation has dolim, and they have a din of a Sanhedrin, and that halacha of kechol asher yorucha applies to them, and in every specific place, that halacha applies to the Torah authority of that place. And when there is difference of opinion, that's not for this topic. There are rules of how to what you follow, who you follow, when you follow, or whatever, where there's a rove and a majority opinion, a minority opinion, if it's a Torah inyan, if a rabbinic inyan, and so on. That is the halacha inyan, and that's not too, there's not too much controversy on that. It's pretty clear that there has to be a Torah authority in Klal Yisrael, and that is also dependent on emunas chachamim, that you have trust. Now, emunas chachamim doesn't necessarily mean belief in the chachamim, but it's confidence in them that since they know more than me, I have confidence that if they say something, that is the Dvar Hashem.
Rabbi Lef, can I just interrupt on this point? If you look, let's say, on the Pasuk of Leisasser, right? So the Rambam, the Lashon of Rambam is in the Sefer HaMitzvot, he says it's only on the Bezdin HaGadol, is the Lashon of Rambam. Bezdin HaGadol Shebirushalayim, and on them it says Leisasser. And the Lashon HaRamban on the Pasuk of Yamin Usmail, the Lashon HaRamban is, it goes on those who live in the Beis HaMikdash, because that is where the Kaved Hashem is Shoychein Kal Hayayim. So even on the Isser of Leisasser, the Rishonim seem to say it's when there's a Bezdin HaGadol.
That Ramban are going specifically on the halacha that is mentioned in that context of a Zaken Mamre. The halacha of a Zaken Mamre only applies to the Beis HaGadol in Yerushalayim, when they're in the Lishkas HaGozis, and so on. But the Sefer HaChinuch says very clearly, the Rosh says it in Sanhedrin, in Perek Dalid, Simin Vav, that every generation, right, this halacha, in general, doesn't apply specific to the din of Zaken Mamre, but every generation, the Gadol Hador has a din of a Sanhedrin. And if there are many Gadolim, there's a difference of opinion, so then there are halachas, who to follow, how to follow, or whatever. And every place that accepts upon himself a Rav, he also has a din of the halachic authority, and his word, the halacha of Lo Saser, applies, whether it applies specifically Min HaTorah, or it applies in the spirit of the Torah, that the Rishonim say clearly that it applies not only to the Sanhedrin, but to every Torah authority of every generation.
It's interesting that the Minchas Chinuch, on the Chinuch that you cite, he brings both the Rambam and the Ramban, and he brings that the Chinuch, like you correctly noted, argues on the Rambam and the Ramban. And his Lashon is, Uminayin Leizehiyas on the Chinuch. How does he know this? He says, Shani Bezdin Agadol Asher Kvod Hashem Yisbara Chofef Aleim Kol Hayom.
So he
does note that, like you said, that the Chinuch says that it clearly goes on every generation.
Who was he?
The Minchas Chinuch on the spot.
Okay, fine.
This is the halachic element.
The Rosh also says that, the Rashba also says that in the place, that not only did the Rashba in the place says that the Gadol Hador has the right even to inflict capital punishment, which only the Sanhedrin can do, and only under certain conditions. But L'Horah Shah, Gadol Hador has that koach too. So that koach of the Sanhedrin exists in every generation, even though the halachas of the Sanhedrin specifically, Gabi Zokin Mamre, and other halachas only apply to the Sanhedrin when they're in the Lishkas HaGozis and so on.
So that was the halachic element, and now you're going to talk about
the halachic
bashkafic element.
That there has to be a Torah authority in Klal Yisrael. Otherwise, the Klal Yisrael can't exist throughout the generations, right? Poskei Hador, and from the time of the Gemara, and the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Gaonim, the Shulchan Aruch, all of that is based on the fact that whatever is paskin by the gedolim of a generation, right, becomes halacha. And future generations sometimes can argue on that and sometimes not, if they are not on the level to be able to argue with the previous generations because of niskatnu hadoros. That's the halacha inyan. And that's not there's not too much place in there for leeway. However, even when it comes to medical things and social or economic things, where it bears on halacha, for instance, should a person fast on Yom Kippur or not, depends on refuah. You have to ask a doctor. On the other hand, the doctor can't paskin. He can tell you what the situation is. He can't tell you if that situation is matter you to eat on Yom Kippur or not. So there also, the halachic authority can't take responsibility for defining the parameters of the medical question. But once the medical question is resolved or clarified, then the halachic authority takes over and decides whether what the doctor said, the halacha applies that you can eat on Yom Kippur or not. So even when it comes to refuah, when it comes to economics, whatever, where it bears on halacha, for sure the Das Torah can't paskin the medical shaila or the economic shaila. But the Das Torah is necessary to take the medical and economic information and put it into the context of halacha. That's also pretty much halacha.
So what happens, Rabbi Leff, if your Rosh Yeshiva says you should not vaccinate your child and your doctor says that you should?
If your Rosh Yeshiva says that he has a clear halachic reason why it's wrong to do that, whatever there's a sakana or whatever that because of that sakana halachically will be wrong, then you have to listen to the Rosh Yeshiva. That is obviously not the case, right? If your Rosh Yeshiva says that, we'll get to that in a second, where it comes to not hashkafa, not halacha, and purely things that are not governed by halacha or hashkafa, like this, like vaccinating your child, if there's no halachic reason not to do it, which I'm not aware of a halachic reason not to vaccinate your child. But it's just an idea of what you should do that has no relation to halacha and hashkafa. That I'll tell you one second what, if there is an idea of Das Torah there or not. In hashkafa, the Chazon Ish, in a letter, Tzadik Beis in his Igoros, says clearly that those people who differentiate between halacha and hashkafa and follow the Das of Gedolei Yisrael when it comes to halacha, but don't follow the Das of Gedolei Yisrael when it comes to hashkafa. Hashkafa meaning things that have bearing on halacha, on halichas olam, right? On what's mutter, what's asur, what is an emuna, what's not emuna, or whatever. That is the beginning of the haskalah, the beginning of minus. That is totally not a Torah approach to things, because Torah applies both to halacha and to hashkafa, and they are equal when it comes to following the authority of Torah leaders.
Could you give an example? What would an example of that be?
What would be a proper emuna, let's say, something to do with halacha of waiting for Mashiach, right? What would be a proper way to fulfill that? Right, what does it entail? It's not basically a pure halachic thing, but it's hashkafa. It's a total perspective on something. There also is a domain of halachic authorities. The how about when it comes to things that are etzes, advice, like your example. Should I vaccinate my child or not? The Rav is not telling you there's a halacha that he holds that it's halachically not okay, hashkafically it's not okay. Telling you an Eitz HaTovah. So there is, very interesting, there is a Igeres from the Baal HaTanya, nonetheless, who says that in areas that have nothing to do with halacha and nothing to do with hashkafa, there is no idea to go to a Talmud Chacham, to a Gadol, and ask advice in these inyanim. That you go to a Navi, and when there are no Neviim, right? Eitzes are only in Torah, not in things that have nothing to do with Torah, like perhaps your example of vaccination, the Sabbala Tanya. Others, however, say that there is an idea to ask an Eitzah, right? It's not binding as halacha and hashkafa, but an ask an Eitzah from Talmud Chacham who has, what is Das Torah? Right? You have a munas chachamim that when a chacham tells you something, he's telling you what the Ratzon Hashem is. How does he know? So a few ways. First of all, the idea of Das Torah is someone who is immersed in Torah. And the more immersed he is, and the more that his database, his entire foundation of knowledge is based on Torah, so his conclusions and how he looks at things, he looks at it through the eyes of the Torah and not through the eyes of other factors. So that's one idea of Das Torah. You want to get an Eitzah of how the Torah would look at something, ask from someone who is permeated, immersed totally in Torah. That's the first thing. Rabbi Chana Wasserman says, it's brought down in Oral Chanan, that there has to be a few other conditions also for a person to qualify to be called a Das Torah when it comes especially to these kind of advice or whatever that's not halachic and not hashkafic. One is he has to be a tzaddik. He has to be a Yerushalmi. That's the first thing. Secondly, he has to not have negiyus in that specific area. Negiyus meaning a monetary. He's not biased monetarily in his own favor in that inyan. And that person then has siyata d'shmaya. The Rabbanu Shel Olam gives him a certain amount of aid in coming to the proper conclusion. And as Chazal say in the Bava Basra, that when the time Nevuah was taken away, it was taken away from the Nevi'im, but the Chachamim with their Chachma have a different kind of Nevuah, a certain intuition as to Ratzon Hashem. And therefore, asking the advice of a Talmud Chacham, of a person who's totally immersed in Torah, you're getting Das HaTorah. You're not getting his opinion. You're getting what his understanding of the opinion of the Torah would be in this inyan. It is not binding as a halacha and hashkafa, but if a person feels that he can trust the person who's giving him that advice, and the person is giving it and telling you that this is how he understands from his vast knowledge of Torah, this is how he understands what Ratzon Hashem would be, then a person can have confidence that's a good Eitzah.
Again, now, when we refer today to for the most part, let's say in yeshivas or schools or about Aguda conventions as Das Torah, are they for the most part referring to this third element, the Eitzah Das Torah?
Yes and no. A lot of times they're referring to things that have to do with Klal Yisrael, that have to do with hashkafas, meaning what is the proper derech for Klal Yisrael to take in a certain issue or whatever, based on halacha and hashkafa. So there it's more rooted in halacha and hashkafic inyonim. These inyonim are more either private things that people have of their own daily decisions they have to make. And even though many people, especially in the Hasidic world, consider these things to be a clear Das Torah, not so simple, that is an inyan that a person should go with everything that he has, especially what I told you the Bala Tanya says, every gashmiyistika thing that has no bearing on halacha or hashkafa, to ask a godel what to do.
Now, I assume when you're referring to the Rav in Igros HaKodesh in Simen Chafbeis,
right.
Where his language is Hahoisa Kizos Miyamos Olam. Have we ever had thing this
right.
In all time history? His
Lashon is, except by Nevi'im.
He says, where have we found the minig to this in all of Chachmei Yisrael, Harishonim v'Acharonim? Where have we ever found Lios minig v'tikun lishol be'eses gashmias binyanim gashmias? Where have we found the concept of asking corporeal, physical matters, ma lasos binyanim ha'olam ha'gashmi? Only,
right.
he says, if you search through all the Svarim, you will not find all the Chachmei Yisrael, Rishonim, the Tanoim, Amoraim, that knew all the secrets of heaven and earth, of all the constellations, that they would give advice on anything like this except for the Nevi'im. So it's ironic, I find it actually ironic, that the Hasidim, who, I mean, this is where mostly it comes from, asking...
Right, exactly. That's what I said. It's very ironic
and
that
the Balat Tanya is the one who...
the source of... doesn't mean that others don't disagree, right? There is an idea of a person should ask an Eitzah, and the best Eitzah to ask is Min HaTorah. How do you ask an Eitzah from the Torah? From somebody who's a Sefer Torah Chai?
But it's an extremely strong language. Ha'hosa kizos mi'amos olam. And he says, I have not found in my search of all the Sfarim. The Balat Tanya was a great Baki. And he says, in all this, mikol sifrei chachmei Yisrael harishonim v'acharonim. Quite a powerful statement to say. And he lived around 250 years ago. So he says, as of 250 or 300 years ago, there was no such a concept in any Sefer to ask Binyanim Gashmiim. And now it's 300 years later, and we've done a complete 180-degree about, reverse, where we ask everything. So it's quite an astonishing fact, the Balat Tanya, that you've brought up.
Right. There's an interesting Michtav Meliyahu also. The Michtav Eliyahu says that the worst klola, worst of the 98 klolas that are mentioned in the Torah, asher lo kosu b'sefer, is siluk ha-tzadikim, that the Rav Shlomo takes away the gedolim. And he explains why. He says that one of the averas, or one of the practices that led to the churban, was that they did on mitzvahs anoshim lumada. They didn't think into the mitzvahs they were doing, they did them by rote. He says one of the reasons they did that is because they relied on other people to think for them. They didn't think for themselves at all, and they relied on tzaddikim or whatever to do their thinking, and therefore the Rebbeinu takes away the tzaddikim, and they're forced then to think on their own. Even Das Torah in these areas isn't that the Chacham should think for you, but he should point out to you when a person needs an Eitzah, so he's very Nogeya B'davar. He knows what he'd like the answer to be, and subliminally, right, subconsciously, he looks for the positive in that, what he wants, and the negative in the options that he doesn't want. You need somebody to give you an objective view of what your issue is, and then to direct you to be able to make the right choice. A person who can not only give you an objective view, but give you a Torah view, how the Rabban Shom would look at it, is even extra special. But he's giving you the information you need now to make the decision. He's not making the decision for you. In these areas, there's no psak, there's no hora, there's an eitzah.
We're speaking to... I'm sorry, continue.
Point out enough information that you can now make an intelligent choice, knowing what the factors are.
We're speaking to Rabbi Zev Lef of Moshev Matisyo. And the topic we're asking him is about Das Torah. He's also the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Gedola Matisyo and one of the most noted English, prolific English-speaking Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. Here are a number of questions we've got received from our listeners. I've often gone to advice to Rabbi Kanievsky in Bnei Brak, and I've had around 30 seconds to relay a complex question, and I've received a two-word answer. Do you think that I'm getting good advice when he clearly, in those 30 seconds, I cannot relay my entire familial, social, cultural, financial situation, and in the two-word answer, he cannot clearly convey his intent? Is that a good use of Das Torah, or would I be better off speaking to just a wise local counselor?
Okay, I'm not the one to judge Reb Chaim Kanievsky. However, in my experience from my Rebbeim, I'm a Telzer. My Rebbe was Reb Mordechai Gifter and Reb Chaim Stein, Reb Baruch Sorotskin, Zichronim Levracha. Our Mesora was a little bit different than what is here in Eretz Israel today. For sure, Chazal say that you have to go El Hashofet Asher Yiyeh Bayomim Hohem. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says the reason is that the person has to know your circumstances. Right? If you could go to the Vilna Gaon, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, it wouldn't be okay to go today. The Vilna Gaon doesn't know the circumstances of this generation. And that applies to every individual, too. Someone who can give you an Eitzah has to know, and even to Paskin Shilas, has to know the circumstances, your specific circumstances, has to know you specifically, and an Adam Gadol can have the same Shila from two people and give completely different advice based on who they are. So, obviously, the best kind of advice is to go to someone who knows you, who can either knows you or can get to know you, can hear all of the factors involved in the issue that you're bringing up, and that is the ideal kind of advice to get. Whether there are Anoshim Gedolim, who the Rabban Shalom has tremendous siyata d'shmaya with, who are so immersed in Torah that they have a special siyata d'shmaya, their brachas are brachas or whatever, it's more of a chassidish bent, but in Eretz Yisrael it's become, even in the Litvisha world, a little bit similar. Again, are there people like Reb Chaim Kanievsky, whose advice takes on the form of a bracha, or that he is blessed with a certain Ruach HaKodesh, which I use very, very cautiously, but Ruach HaKodesh that comes from, like Chazal say, that Nitla Nevuah Mehanevim VeNitla Chachomim. There's a certain intuition in Ruach HaKodesh that the Rabban Shem gave to the Chachomim. I'm not the one to judge whether Reb Chaim Kanievsky has that or not. He's a Adam Gadol Ma'od. But on a different level, it definitely is beneficial for a person, even if he's going to get a bracha like that and an eitzah like that, to go to someone who knows him, who's also a person who is a Torah person, and let that person then be the filter between him and Reb Chaim Kanievsky to explain to him or to decide whether what Reb Chaim Kanievsky said to him fits him or doesn't fit him.
Okay, so here's a question from Jeremy from the Five Towns. I am having Shalom Bayis issues. Should I be going to my Rav for Das Torah or to a marriage counselor?
Okay, it depends what the issues are. I always have tainas both on Rabbonim and on social workers. Rabbonim have smicha. They do not have a degree in social work. Now, if a Rav has experience in social work, fine. But if he doesn't, his smicha didn't give him that experience. Social workers have a degree in social work. They don't have smicha. And therefore, I abhor social workers who get mixed into telling people what really a Rav should tell them halachically, and Rabbonim who get involved in telling people what to do psychiatrically, psychologically, or from a social worker standpoint, and they don't have that experience. I think there has to be a partnership between them, because there are areas that overlap both. A Rav should be able to direct someone with Shalom Bayis problems that need the experience of how to deal with them, with people who have that experience, who have been taught that experience, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever it may be. And the Rav should be smart enough to know where he can give it over. Just like somebody comes to a Rav with a medical shaila, if he's not an MD, he can't tell him medically what to do. But he can send him to a qualified doctor, and then when he has that information, if there are halachic overlaps, come back to me, tell me what that expert said, and with his expertise and his knowledge, and I'll tell you what the halacha overlap is, how that knowledge, medical knowledge will impact on halacha. There has to be a partnership. So perhaps you should go to the Rav first. Hopefully the Rav is a chacham and a pikeach to know where it is his expertise and where he has to go and send the person to someone who has expertise he doesn't have, and work together with that person where there is an overlap of halacha and social, psychological issues.
So clearly, Rabbanim should not be giving purely medical advice. That's what seems to
me. Unless they're doctors who went to medical school.
Yeah. Okay, can we chat? We're speaking. We have the honor of having with us on the ear from Eretz Yisrael, from Eretz HaKodesh, Rabbi Zev Leff, the famous speaker, the prolific writer. Rabbi Leff, I'd like to switch topics with you for a minute. It's almost Elul, and people are starting to prepare to go to Uman. And even though I've never had the honor of being there, but I understand that they now get literally tens of thousands of people. And I would like to hear your opinion on going to Uman. I know for many people it's a very spiritual and it's an uplifting, you know, activity. But, you know, they're coming from Eretz Yisrael, thousands and thousands of people, and they could daven by the Kaisel, where the Shechina is still Shari, according to Chazal. They could daven by the graves of our patriarchs, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, you know, Rachel and Leah, by the Kivrei Avos. They could, if they wanted, they could daven by the Arizal. They could daven by the Beis Yosef, the Sveltnishtois, Rebbes, Tzadikim.
They can daven in their Mokum Kavua in the shul where they daven all the time, which is a bigger Indian, perhaps.
They could daven there. And they go to Uman, where not only are they leaving their mishpacha behind, and they're leaving Eretz Yisrael, which is halachically problematic, and additionally, they are pumping millions and millions of dollars, could be tens of millions of dollars, into an economy that has been remarkably hostile. I mean, it's a stone's throw from Babi Yar, right? I mean, what is you feel, since we're speaking about Das Torah, what is your feeling about going to Uman for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur?
Okay, you threw in a lot of issues over there. First of all, I don't know if I am qualified to answer this question since I've never been in Uman. I'm not a Breslover Chassid, and I'm not that familiar of what goes on over there. Okay, so with that caveat, let me tell you what I think. Everything you said is true. First of all, leaving Eretz Yisrael, if you leave temporarily for a mitzvah, if it is a mitzvah, that's okay. A person, if you want to know Me'ikar HaInyan, where a person should daven, Yomim Noroyim, isn't the place where he normally davens. A person should daven in Makom Kavua, in a place where his Rav is, in a place where his Chaverim are, definitely with his family. That is what would be as a base. However, if a person knows that for some reason all of that scenario for some reason does not give him the hisoris that he really feels he needs. And he feels that perhaps going like Chassidim go, going to the Rebbe for Yom Noroyim, or by Litvaks, going back to their yeshiva, right? Plenty of people came back to Telz Yeshiva for Rosh Hashanah, some with their families, some without their families, because they felt that since this is the beginning of the year and the foundation and root of anything is what sets the pattern for everything that comes after that, and therefore they're doing their family a service by having that hisoris, so they'll miss them by the meals, but they'll gain the entire year because of that, and they're actually going for something that is legitimately a spiritual feeling that is rooted in real spirituality, not what people sometimes call spirituality. It has nothing to do with spirituality. If that's the case, I could hear that someone who is doing that legitimately and really feels that their davening will be better and it will set a foundation and root for their entire year, then their families will gain. It's a mitzvah, and they can leave Eretz Yisrael even temporarily, and if they don't get that same feeling by davening by the Kosel or by the Kivrei Avos or whatever, and they get that feeling in Uman because they have some kind of connection to Breslev, Matov Umanoyim, perhaps. But somebody who goes because it's exciting, I have no idea what goes on over there, and perhaps their davening is not going to be as kavua as it should be, and it's not going to be a really ruchniyistika strengthening of their ruchnius, but just what they would consider a spiritual high because it's exciting, then I would frown on people doing that and substituting sugar-coated spirituality for something substantial and really ruchnius that perhaps if they worked on a little bit more, would be able to get those same feelings in their mokum kavua, in their shul, together with their families.
Now, you're saying take spirituality from whatever motivates you. And if somebody really feels motivated and that is the place that speaks to their heart. If that's what turns him on and will motivate him in a true way, then he should. Then that sounds like perfectly acceptable.
The emphasis on a true way that is legitimate spirituality, not bona fide, not something that's bogus.
Well, Rabbi Leff, that was really, on both points, I found you to be just inspirational, incredibly knowledgeable, and speak with just authoritatively, with just common sense. Hard to disagree with you on either point. And I thank you. And, you know, on behalf of all our thousands of listeners, I would like to thank you and from taking the time from Eretz Yisrael to join us today on Headlines. Thank you and for joining us.
Thank you.
We have with us on the phone the executive vice president of the Aguda, Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, a Talmud Chacham, the leader of the largest Haredi organization in the Western Hemisphere, also a noted constitutional lawyer. It's an honor to have him with us. I hear your opinion on the recent Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. If you could give us a little bit of thought on that.
Well, this was a disappointing ruling, to put it mildly, but not entirely unexpected. I believe that the issue of gay marriage or same-sex marriage is one that was eventually confirmed by the Supreme Court, but really the battle had been carried out in many other forums, including popular culture and other places, where a long time ago already, the last number of years, it has become pretty clear that the culture has embraced this lifestyle as a perfectly legitimate lifestyle. Efforts to in any way change that lifestyle are viewed now with hostility. There are even efforts to ban mental health professionals from providing therapy designed to help people change their lifestyle or their orientation or to control their orientation.
Are you referring to the Jonah ruling that came out in New Jersey 2 weeks ago?
Well, I'm not referring specifically to Jonah, and as a matter of fact, reading some of the descriptions of what Jonah was doing with some of these therapies, I don't believe that all mental health professionals would agree with their methodology. But there are very mainstream mental health professionals in our own community who have been working with young people who have the challenge of being attracted to members of the same gender and would like to control that and very much want to remain part of the mainstream of our society and our community. And these mental health professionals use perfectly well accepted and mainstream types of therapies that can be helpful to these young people. But we're now facing a larger culture where the society around us, already in California and New Jersey, and I think one or two other states, where by law these mental health professionals would not be permitted to provide this type of therapy to young people. So my point is that society around us has been changing very dramatically over the last several decades, to the point where this was not really unexpected. It was sad to read the decision, to note that the three Jewish justices on the Supreme Court all were in the majority in this case. Potential impact of a decision like this is really staggering in a lot of different ways. The dissenting opinions pointed out, and we pointed this out also in a friend of the court brief that Agudat Yisrael submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court when the case was being considered. The dissenting justices pointed out that this could jeopardize the tax-exempt status of religious institutions that refuse to recognize gay marriage. In many different ways, religious institutions and religious individuals can be considered pariahs as a result of their refusal to accept the notion of same-sex marriage. I remember years ago there was a case involving the Boy Scouts that went all the way to the Supreme Court. They had a policy at that time of not allowing openly gay people to have certain positions of leadership within the Boy Scouts. And by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court upheld the Boy Scouts' rights to have such a policy. Well, they were constitutionally permitted to have that policy, but all of a sudden they encountered all kinds of penalties that were being imposed upon them by governments all across the country. They used to be able to receive certain benefits, certain contracts with government agencies to carry out their activities, but now that they were exposed as having this policy of not allowing gay people to serve in leadership roles, well, in that case, we're not going to subsidize that anymore. We're not going to get into contracts with you, Boy Scouts. And the Boy Scouts were brought to their knees, having won the case in the Supreme Court and being allowed to establish that type of policy. Nonetheless, they were treated as pariahs. They were treated as bigots. And the same thing is true, I'm afraid, and will be true, I'm afraid, with respect to religious communities like ours. Once this becomes the standard that's accepted in all of society, and if you don't buy into it, then wait a minute, you're a hater, you're a bigot, and therefore you're a second-class citizen. So there really is a very tangible potential danger to our institutions and our community, and I think that this is one of those occasions where we will have to show our mettle. We will have to, without backing down in any way from our position, continue to articulate our position. We're flying against the stream now of the broader society around us. What makes this so much more painful for us and in many ways difficult for us is that within the larger Jewish community, we're a small little minority voice. The a poll was published recently that showed that the American Jewish community, more than any other community across the United States, supported same-sex marriage. And they have been in the forefront. And in this case, in the United States Supreme Court, briefs were submitted on behalf of 13 different Jewish groups, including the Reform and the Reconstructionist and the conservative movements, all of them saying that our rabbis perform these marriages, and these marriages should be considered legitimate, regular marriages. And the only Jewish voice on the other side of the equation was that of Agudat Yisrael. We were the only ones saying that, no, this is contrary to Jewish tradition. Our rabbis will not perform these marriages. Jewish law does not sanction the matrimony of people of the same gender. To be a lonely voice, on the one hand, it's a schus, and it's our honor to do that, because obviously that's what we're here for, to stand up for MS and to combat the falsification of Torah values and the zeus haTorah that is being promulgated and perpetrated by the non-Orthodox movements on this issue, unfortunately. So we're very proud of that, but at the same time, the fact that this now seems to be mainstream within the Jewish world to support this kind of marriage and this type of lifestyle is something that is so, so terribly painful, and I think that we as a community need to remain firm, recognize that this is one of those moments in the history of Klal Yisrael where, you know, there is a Mila Shem Eli component to all of this. We're at one of that moments in history, and it is a challenge for us, just as it is a challenge, by the way, and we need to recognize this, that there are people in our community who do have these attractions, and we as a society need to figure out and understand how best to deal with them, how to, on the one hand, make them feel like they're part and parcel of Klal Yisrael, which of course they are, and to help them in meeting the challenges that they face. I think it's a very serious issue. Speaking to mechanchim, people who are involved in the field of chinuch, and rabbanim and shuls, this is by no means an isolated, very rare type of situation, but there are significant numbers of people who face this challenge. And some of them want to desperately overcome these challenges. And
how would you, Rabbi Zwiebel, how would you, what would you counsel a mechanach who is encountering a child who had these issues, or a teenager, or an adult? How would you counsel him? What should he tell this individual?
Well, you know, the good news is that they don't ask me for counsel, but if anything, I ask them for how they handle these situations. I'm trying, and when we are trying, I think as a, you know, as an organization that tries to get a handle on the problems that are facing the community, we have been speaking over the last couple of years, really, to some rabbanim about this and to a number of mental health professionals. It's one of the reasons why I believe so strongly that it is important for the therapy option to remain, of course, responsible therapy, but therapy option to remain on the table, for society now to pass laws that prevent mental health professionals from helping these young people who have these challenges. That, I think, is going to take away one of the only effective tools that has been developed in helping people within our society, within our community, who want to be part of our society and community and yet face these challenges, to help them as they struggle to control and overcome this particular challenge.
Rabbi Zubel, let me ask you a question that has troubled me. And is it important that we take a position on this? Like, we've debated in the past, what is the chiyuv of Klal Yisrael to the Umay Sa'ilim as far as the Zion mitzvahs? Are we supposed to be promulgating the Zion mitzvahs? Like, we have walls built around our community. We have our own yeshivas, our own meisters, and it's like, why don't we take the attitude of this is for us and that's for you and do as you please, and why make these, you know, both expensive, time consuming, and ultimately, unsuccessful appeals, etc., when it's really not our business?
So I think that there are two important.
I'm not taking that position. I'm asking it as a question.
I understand, and it's a very important question, and it's a fundamental question. Having sat in and meetings of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah for the last 30 years, Baruch Hashem, so I think I know in broad terms the outline to the answer to that question. And there are two important points that I think are to be made. Number one is that it is our issue because it will have a tangible impact on us, as I mentioned earlier, if our view is relegated to the view of the haters of society, of the bigots of society, the pariahs who are not part of mainstream society. If mainstream society moves so far away from where we are that our tax exemption becomes vulnerable, as the dissenting justice has pointed out in the Supreme Court, as our ability to enjoy certain basic governmental benefits will come under pressure because of our position on these issues. So how society comes down on this question does have potentially a very tangible impact on us. So that's one reason why it was important and is important for us to get involved in these kinds of issues, so that we're not branded as outliers, as people who are, chutz l'machna of civilized society. And number two, the second point, and this is something that I remember in the context of yet another issue, abortion, where the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah in the late 1980s, if I remember correctly, was confronted with the question of whether Agudas Yisrael should submit a friend of the court brief to the United States Supreme Court in one of the cases that was then coming before the Supreme Court on the abortion area. And we had never done so before. Just at that time, there was a full-page ad taken out in the New York Times and a number of other major newspapers around the world from the reform movement, and perhaps there were other Jewish groups as well, that spoke about the importance of protecting women's reproductive freedom and how it's a basic religious tenet and how under Jewish law the Jewish woman always gets to choose and so on. Again, falsifying our halacha, falsifying the Torah in the glaring spotlight of the New York Times, and with the statement that they're going to the Supreme Court to get the Supreme Court to overturn these restrictions on abortion. So when the Gedolei Yisrael around the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah table saw this ad and saw these announcements about how the reform is going into the uh, to the uh, Supreme Court to make the arguments, they said it was very important, not so much because we want to influence the outcome of the case, which would be nice if we could, but really more importantly to announce to the world that what you've heard from the Reform community does not represent normative Judaism. It does not represent authentic halacha. This is not the perspective of the Torah, and they don't speak for the Jewish community. And it's very important for us to say that loudly and clearly in the pages of the newspapers, in the pages of the presentations that are made in the United States Supreme Court, which is where all the attention is, less so for the benefit of accomplishing a victory in the legal battle, but more to the point of rescuing the Torah from the terrible chilo, the terrible zius that is being perpetrated by the other Jewish groups. That's certainly true with respect to this question of same-gender marriage and the obligation upon us not to sit by silently and say it's none of our business, it's not our issue, when there are other Jewish groups who are so publicly and so outrageously distorting Torah, our Gedolim feel we just can't.
So let me go off topic, one last question, Rabbi Zio, while I have you. Talking about Ziyuf HaTorah, what do you think of the recent ordination by a rabbi in New York of a number of women with the title of rabbi? What is a so-called Orthodox rabbi? Does the Aguda have a position on that?
Sure. I mean, I've been a Minsker Rebbe at the Aguda dinner last year. Spoke very, very powerfully, forcefully against a number of developments that are taking place at the on the left fringes of Orthodoxy. An entire movement that is going under the banner of open orthodoxy, which is in a variety of ways making fundamental changes to our Masorah, all under the name of orthodoxy. That was a year ago. This latest pirtza, if I may, this latest breach in what should be considered normative Jewish practice of ordaining women and actually having them assume the title rabbi, is just yet another indication of how people can abrogate for themselves the title of orthodoxy, but in fact take steps that are very outside the mainstream of orthodoxy, normative Orthodox Judaism, totally unacceptable and frankly a major danger, because in communities around the country who are looking for an Orthodox rabbi to lead their congregations, there's a truth in advertising issue over here.
Well, their rabbis aren't rabbis. I mean, it's simply. I mean, a rabbi who does this is just, he's not a rabbi. It's like the quote,
may understand that and know that, but out there in the broader community.
The Jewish mother was talking to her son who told her he was a captain of a boat. He said, "Tell me, sweetie, I think you're a captain and you think you're a captain, but do the captains also think you're a captain?" So I say to the rabbis who are ordinating women, I said, "You call yourself rabbi and your wife may call you rabbi, but do the real rabbis call you rabbi?" Well, okay. Thank you very much. It was really a great honor, and it was great to have the clarification on many issues. You've heard where we've been speaking to the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the erudite, articulate, executive vice president of the Agudas Yisrael, an organization that's been around for probably well over 100 years. And it's been an honor to have you, and thank you very much. And Rabbeinu Shalom should give you koyach to continue doing on behalf of our tzibur your wonderful acts that you promulgate.
Amen. Thank you so much, Rav David. And, you say so many nice things about me. I want to come back more often on your program.
Thank you. We look forward to having you.
Okay. Agudavach. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We just finished the Yom Tov of Tu B'Av. We're between, Tisha B'Av and Elul. And there's something really amazing about these days that I thought it's worth mentioning. What was Tisha B'Av about? The Chet HaMeraglim. And what were the Meraglim about? They said, Loi nuchal lalois. We cannot, it's beyond us. We cannot enter the promised land. And how does both the Maral on the Litvish side, the Chidush Arim on the Hasidish side, how do they explain this? they say, you know, in the Midbar, they lived an existence that was just sort of spiritual. It was academic. They ate food that was unreal. It was the man. It was a spiritual food. The water came from a bear. They were living like this dreamlike existence. Entering Eretz Yisrael, the promised land, that's hard work. And they said, you know what? In theory, it's great. We just can't do all that hard work. We can't. It's too hard for us. We want to stay on Kest. We want to live in our in-laws' basement. We don't want to, you know, we want to stay in school. We don't want to go, you know, they say those who can do, those who can't teach. We don't want to do. It's scary. The world is a very scary place. That was the Meraglim. And the Rambam writes in the Pirush HaMishnayos, he says, what is the holiday of Tu B'Av? This is the Rambam at the end of Tainus when it says, L'hayyam tovim b'Yisrael k'may Tu B'Av v'yayim Kippurim. It was one of the great holidays of the year. What was the holiday of Tu B'Av? So the Rambam writes, all the people in the Midbar, all the Yotzei Mitzrayim, were destined to die. They were cursed. They got anathematized by Kav Yochel that they were going to die because of the chait of the chait HaMeraglim. So every year, most of the death happened on Tisha B'Av. So he said the last year, when Tisha B'Av came around, nobody died. So they said, you know what? We must have made a mistake in the date. Maybe it's not the 9th, maybe it's the 8th, maybe then the next day came. When Tu B'Av came, what's Tu B'Av? It's the middle of the month, and the moon then starts getting smaller. And they said, oh no, it can't be. Tisha B'Av must have passed, and the death has stopped. So the Lashon HaRambam is, Bitzchu B'Nafsham, they started to believe in themselves again. Right? They started to believe, Hashavas Chamasa, he said, Chazru Liftoyach Ba'atzman, they began to believe in their own existence. They got self-confidence again. So think of it. The chait of the Meraglim was, they didn't have self-confidence in themselves. What's Tu B'Av? They believed that they had a purpose, that they had a destiny. So what are these days of? These are the days, if we want to accept the Yom Tov of Tu B'Av, we should get up every day now, these days, and look in the mirror and say, I believe that I have a purpose. This is the holiday of Tu B'Av. These are the days coming up to El. I have a purpose. There is a meaning to my existence. There is a purpose. I am important. You are important. That is the holiday of Tu B'Av vis-a-vis Tisha B'Av. Next week, our guests will be Rabbi Ari Marburger, and the topic will be going to secular court. Do we have to go to Beis Din, or there are times when we can go to secular court, especially given that there are many people who are critical of the Beis Din process, and they say it's not a good place to litigate. Additionally, besides having Rabbi Ari Marburger, who's local from Lakewood, we're going to go overseas again. We're going to go to Rabbi Usher Weiss, the Baal Mincha Sasha. We've already had Rabbi Heinemann speak about the kosher switch. Now let's hear what the Mincha Sasha, the famous Dayan from Eretz Yisrael, the head of Shari Tzedek, one of the cutting edge Paiskim in Eretz Yisrael, what is his opinion about the kosher switch? We have East, we have West, he's Hasidish, Ari Marburger's Lichtenberg from Lakewood. We cover all the bases here. Thank you very much. I look forward to speaking to you again next week.